Welcome to an excerpt of the CME Activity, Atopic Dermatitis Update, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Mark Lebwohl, MD, Amy Paller, MD, and Elaine C. Siegfried, MD. Dr. Lebwohl is a professor and chair, Department of Dermatology, Mount Sinai School of Medicine, New York, New York. Dr. Lebwohl has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Abgenomics International, Actelion Pharmaceuticals U.S., Allos Therapeutics, Almirall, Amgen, Astellas Pharma, Bioline Rx, Dermagenoma, Dermasor, Genentech, Helix Biomedics, Janssen Biotech, Leo Pharma, Luitpold Pharmaceuticals, Novartis, Onset Dermatologics, Pfizer, Stiefel, a GlaxoSmithKline company, and Valeant Pharmaceuticals. He received grants for clinical research from Clinuvel Pharmaceuticals, Celgene Corporation, and Leo Pharma. Dr. Lebwohl does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Lebwohl does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Paller is a Walter J. Hamlin Professor and Chair, Department of Dermatology, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Paller has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She received grants for clinical research from Astellas Pharma U.S. Dr. Paller does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Paller does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Siegfried is a professor of pediatrics and dermatology, director, pediatric dermatology, St. Louis University, director, pediatric dermatology, Cardinal Glennon Children's Medical Center, St. Louis, Missouri. Dr. Siegfried has disclosed no relevant financial relationships. Dr. Siegfried does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Siegfried does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to review the pathophysiology and topical treatment of atopic dermatitis. This activity is supported by Valeant Pharmaceuticals International. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mark Lebwohl. I'm professor and chairman of the Department of Dermatology at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York. I would like to welcome you to this Medscape program entitled Atopic Dermatitis Update. I'm pleased to be joined today by my colleagues, Dr. Elaine Siegfried, professor of pediatrics and dermatology at St. Louis University, and Dr. Amy Paller, who is professor of dermatology and of pediatrics and chairman of the Department of Dermatology at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. I welcome you both to today's discussion. Our topic today is atopic dermatitis, and I'm going to start by discussion of the Hanifin-Rajka criteria, which have been the oldest criteria we have for atopic dermatitis, and probably the most widely accepted, although there are many other criteria out there, mostly modifications of these. Among the key points in the major criteria that are discussed are the necessity to have pruritus. Itching is an important part of atopic dermatitis. Second criterion is dermatitis affecting flexural areas in adults and the face and extensor surfaces in infants. The dermatitis should be either chronic or relapsing. In other words, it comes and goes, but it's there intermittently or chronically. And last but not least, patients often will have a personal or family history of other atopic diseases, asthma, hay fever, or eczema. There are many minor criteria that Hanifin and Rajka have described, and just to highlight a few of them, characteristic clinical findings like Denny Morgan creases under the eyes, environmental factors that trigger atopic dermatitis, cutaneous infections, elevated IgE, an early age of onset is characteristic of atopic dermatitis, but again, none of these are absolute requirements. The conditions often associated with conditions such as ichthyosis vulgaris or keratosis pilaris, hand and foot dermatitis is common in patients with atopic dermatitis, and nipple eczema is often fairly specific for atopic dermatitis. Now, the photos I'm going to show you are characteristic pictures of patients with atopic dermatitis. And again, in young patients, often we have eczematous patches on the extensor surfaces of extremities. You see the legs here. The face is often involved in children. You see a little Denny Morgan's crease there under the right eye of this patient. As kids grow older, they develop the characteristic features and locations that we see in adults. So often the antecubital or popliteal fossae are involved. Often the flexural area of the neck is affected in atopic dermatitis. Now, patients can have their entire cutaneous surface affected. And here's an unfortunate patient. You can see most of his back, the area above his intergluteal cleft, his arms, legs, the retroauricular fold, and the area around his ear and his face affected. So it can be a really severe condition. Histologically, the hallmark is epidermal edema, and on close-up of that epidermis, you can see the spaces between cells are what we call epidermal edema or spongiosis, and often that edema can be so profound that you actually get microvesicles forming in the skin, as shown here. So with that, I am going to turn to Dr. Siegfried, who will discuss the pathogenesis of atopic dermatitis.
Atopic dermatitis is the most common chronic inflammatory disease in the world, and it's a disease mostly of children. Really, it's probably not one disease, but multiple of them, and that's one of the things that's really hampered our understanding of the pathogenesis of the disease. It not just affects the skin, but it affects multiple other organ systems, the upper airway, the GI tract, pulmonary. It has profound effect on sleep and also psychologic effects as well. One of the big confounding factors in our understanding of the pathogenesis of atopic dermatitis is that it's managed by multiple subspecialties and it's studied by multiple different kinds of subspecialists. And out of those subspecialty views of atopic dermatitis has come competing hypotheses for the primary pathogenesis of the disease. And the initial one was called, in general, people called it inside out. And more recently, we're talking a little bit more about outside in pathogenesis of atopic dermatitis. So the initial focus was really on immune dysregulation and specifically adaptive immune dysregulation. And there have been multiple abnormalities identified. And more recently, people have been focusing, particularly dermatologists have been focusing on barrier epithelial and also innate immune defects as part of the barrier epithelium. And that's been the strongest genetic evidence for these kind of defects in atopic dermatitis. So we know that there's a lot of immune dysregulation that it goes on in people with atopic dermatitis, and we know that because a subset of people, and the majority probably with atopic dermatitis, have elevated IgE levels, as well as other atopic diseases like asthma and rhinitis and conjunctivitis, as well as urticaria and food allergies in a subset of patients. So in the setting of normal IgE levels, so that's a smaller subset, and those people don't have elevated IgE levels, which again confounds our understanding of the immune dysregulation that goes on in this disease and also underscores the fact that it's not just one disease, but probably several. Initially, the immune dysregulation hypothesis focused on this imbalance of two T helper lymphocyte subsets, Th1 and Th2. And the original understanding, the hypothesis said, well, it was a Th2 type driven disease. But one of the things that never made that much sense to me, but that's been stressed, is that in the acute phase, Th2 overdrive was the primary immune dysfunction. And in the chronic phase, it was said to be more Th1. So the focus has really been on the TH2 cytokines and TH2 inflammatory products. The historically most prevalent ones were IL-4, IL-13, and a molecule called thymic stromal lymphopoietin, which is emerging as one of the more important cytokines in the pathogenesis and the disease. Then there's TH2 downstream effects and TH2 products as well that have all been studied, and there's a huge amount of information that's been found, but nothing that is so compelling as to give us a single pathogenesis of the disease. So more recently, you know, we know that it's not quite so simple as to say it's a T helper or a T suppressor or a TH1 or a TH2 mediated disease. And we know that not only are there multiple T lymphocyte subsets, but there's also other kinds of cells that participate in the immune dysfunction that is something that results in atopic dermatitis. So many different cell types like NK cells and B lymphocytes and eosinophils, monocytes, and importantly dendritic cells, as well as keratinocytes, play a role in the dysfunction, the immune dysfunction of atopic dermatitis. And now we're finding out about more different forms of cytokines, different kinds of interleukins, as well as the importance of antimicrobial peptides in the skin and type 1 interferons. So not only are there triggers that are exogenous triggers that mostly allergists focus on, but there's endogenous triggers as well. And that's mostly your cutaneous microbes with defective antimicrobial immune responses. So, you know, there's been a really difficulty in understanding immune dysfunction. And part of that problem is that when studying atopic dermatitis, there are so many different subsets, and it's important to distinguish between the subsets.
When we think about the immune system, we need to consider innate immunity as well. Dr. Paller, can you tell us about issues related to innate immunity in atopic dermatitis and how it may play a role?
Sure, I'd be happy to, Mark. So we all know that 80 to 90% of patients with atopic dermatitis harbor Staph aureus in their lesional areas, and in fact, about 50% or more on non-lesional areas can also be found to grow Staph aureus. Interestingly, parents are likely to be nasal carriers, often with the same Staph aureus strain, although it should be noted that there's usually more than one strain per individual and even different strains in lesional versus non-lesional skin. But overall, it has been shown that the severity of the atopic dermatitis correlates with the amount of skin bacteria and also the environmental Staph aureus burden. So when we think about why this is, that brings us to the subject of impaired innate immunity. And when I think about the innate immune process in our skin, I can think about both the epidermal barrier, which we certainly know to be abnormal in patients with atopic dermatitis, and then antimicrobial peptide function. These are the two major areas. Now, we've seen a lot in the last 5 years about filaggrin, filaggrin being a very important protein in the epidermal barrier that we know is depleted or sometimes absent in patients with ichthyosis vulgaris, who themselves have clearly been shown to have a markedly increased risk of developing atopic dermatitis. However, we also know that some of the cytokines that Elaine just talked about, interleukin-4, interleukin-13, will suppress the expression of filaggrin. So this barrier defect has been thought to be very important because it's filaggrin that forms that tightly stacked stratum corneum. But it's important to recognize that filaggrin is not just acting as a structural protein. It also breaks down to what's been called natural moisturizing factor, such as urocanic acid and humectants that basically allow us to retain water and help to lower the pH that's so important to have at the surface of the skin. Now, there are other proteins, for example, that are part of that barrier that are likely to be involved. For example, there was just reported to be a variant form of proline-rich protein 3, another important protein in cross-bridging. And this variant form is markedly increased in individuals with atopic dermatitis. Regardless, it's been shown that these barrier proteins are important in keeping out infections. For example, there's an almost sevenfold increased risk of having 4 or more infections requiring antibiotics in atopic dermatitis patients who have filaggrin mutations versus those without mutations. And it's also been shown that there's decreased expression of other stratum corneum proteins even without showing genetic defects in them. It should also be noted that there's decreased expression of enzymes involved in the generation of the moisturizing factors that we just talked about, the breakdown of filaggrin. So a whole nother area of investigation. So we've been talking about some defects in the epidermal barrier, but we should also remember that the epidermal barrier is also impaired because of the increased expression of proteases, in particular kallikrein. Now, kallikreins are known to degrade intracellular adhesion proteins, so they can break down that barrier that way. They're also increased in their activation at higher pH. So you treat, you know, you put soap on someone, you vigorously wash, you're raising the pH of skin, and that's probably serving to activate these kallikreins. It's not just their role, though, in as proteases, but in fact, it's been shown that kallikrein 5 actually triggers a whole inflammatory cascade that eventuates in the expression of the thymic stromal lymphopoietin that Elaine mentioned, or TSLP, which we now know to be very important in the development of eczema. Finally, we shouldn't just talk about proteins. We all know that there's also decreased lipid as part of that impaired barrier integrity, and particularly a decrease in stratum corneum ceramides. This has resulted in a huge increase in the availability of products that now try to replace that deficient ceramide. I want to also mention that other component of the innate immune system, and that's antimicrobial peptides. So when there is injury to the skin or exposure to pathogens, our normal keratinocyte response is to produce pro-inflammatory cytokines, but also antimicrobial peptides, beta defensins and cathelicidin in particular. There's some controversy right now about actually what's going on with antimicrobial peptides, but there's clear evidence that they're either dysfunctional or insufficient in patients with atopic dermatitis. And this is not necessarily a primary defect, but appears to be from the expression of some of the cytokines that were mentioned before as part of atopic dermatitis. Either way, they're not there or they're not functioning normally, and that's another reason why we see this marked increase in colonization by Staph aureus bacteria.
So patients are colonized as a result of the impaired innate immunity. How does this impact the atopic dermatitis?
Good question. So we know that Staph aureus exacerbates atopic dermatitis. There's been increasing evidence that the way this happens is in many different ways. We've talked for a long time about superantigens, and we know that the superantigens can in themselves inflame skin. They can increase cytokines that are thought to be relevant to atopic dermatitis, activate superantigen-specific and allergen-specific T cells that play a role in exacerbating the atopic dermatitis, and even increasing the expression of interleukin-31, which is a cytokine that specifically been associated with the itchiness, not necessarily inflammation in atopic dermatitis. Interestingly, Jeff Travers and his group have recently reported another way, and that is that the Staph aureus bacteria produces lipoteichoic acid, and this tends to correlate in its expression with the EASI score, so more of it's produced, leading to a worsening of the atopic dermatitis.
How does MRSA fit into all of this?
We've seen a lot about methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. We know that it's dramatically increased in its prevalence. But interestingly, it's still cultured from the minority of patients with atopic dermatitis, anything from about 1% to up in the 30%. And that's lower than what we've seen in cultures in general for Staph aureus. It's been even suggested that by being colonized with methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus, that may be a deterrent to the growth of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, but that remains to be investigated further. I want to mention, though, when we talk about MRSA, we also need to realize that our patients with atopic dermatitis may be resistant to topical antibiotics as well. We've certainly had several patients who are resistant to mupirocin. In Europe, they've seen the same phenomenon with fusidic acid.
Okay, let's talk about topical treatment. Elaine, what do you do for a patient with atopic dermatitis?
I wanted to start out really talking about just simple skin care. And also simple identification and elimination of triggers. We all know about the common things that make kids with atopic dermatitis worse. And now the research is supporting that, but we've always known that dry skin is a problem. We know that using complex topical agents and irritant allergic contact dermatitis that result from that is a problem. And as Amy just pointed out, colonization and infection with microbes is a problem. A smaller subset has a problem with food or environmental allergens. And one of the easiest things to mention, which is sort of a vicious cycle in atopic dermatitis, is sleep deprivation. So the atopic dermatitis causes sleeplessness, and the sleeplessness causes worse of a problem with the atopic dermatitis. So in designing simple topical regimens, the most important thing to focus on is the things that can trigger their disease and also how to help them stick to the complex, sometimes regimens and sometimes time-consuming regimens that we prescribe for them. So we try to simplify that. And as well, I personally spend a lot of time monitoring their medication use. It tells me a lot. So one of the easiest things that kids can do to treat their atopic dermatitis, and also adults, is to do that time-honored technique of taking a bath. Some people call that hydrotherapy. It sounds a little bit more sexy. And when you're bathing, you don't have to overuse cleansers. Using gentle cleansers is the wisest thing to do. And you can also consider some simple antimicrobial techniques with bathing, either bleach or vinegar, Epsom salts, or even antimicrobial, antiperspirant type shampoos. And then one of the most important things is to use a bland ointment. I like ointment emollients, and especially immediately after bathing. Some people hate ointments, and they'll rather use creams. Then when you avoid triggers, again, topical products are a really common trigger and one that's really hard to recognize, particularly kids who are itching everywhere and not just in the typical atopic dermatitis Hanifin-Raja criteria classic, you know, popliteal fossa, antecubital fossa areas. You want to look for other causes in kids who have generalized dermatitis, and topically applied products are one of the most common allergens, one of the most common hidden allergens that can flare disease, and so in things that are in topically applied products. I wanted to talk a little bit about the mainstay of treatment, that's corticosteroids. So that's been the mainstay of treatment for atopic dermatitis for several decades now. We don't exactly know how this medication works. It's been around for such a long time, but we do know that it causes immunosuppression to a certain degree, and it's anti-inflammatory. I think one of the most confusing, difficult parts of using corticosteroid therapy is just being able to choose the right medication. There's so many to choose from. There's literally hundreds of different products. And what you really look at when you're trying to choose the right product for the patient is both the active ingredient, so how potent it is, as well as the vehicle, what it's mixed up in. That's sort of important for both efficacy and acceptance. One of the biggest things that people worry about with corticosteroids is how safe it is and how much you can use. And people are very confused. Patients are very confused. And frankly, I think a lot of primary caregivers are confused about how much corticosteroids to use. They'll frequently give a prescription to a patient and they'll say, use it, but don't use too much. And what is too much? You have to be pretty specific to that for patients. So the adverse effects are really related to the quantity of application, as well as the frequency, and also the duration of application. There's a lot of side effects that are pretty well known, cutaneous atrophy. Also, some other less well-known side effects, perioral dermatitis or folliculitis. And sometimes people complain of hypopigmentation or even hypertrichosis associated with topical corticosteroid application, although I think it may be related to the inflammation as much as it's related to the corticosteroid or even more. And then finally, particularly with children who have a big body surface area to weight ratio, we worry about systemic absorption, not just the measurable side effect of that, which is adrenal axis suppression, but also with long-term use, you can see growth impairment, and then probably a less well-recognized neuropsychiatric effects that certainly is well-publicized for systemic corticosteroids, but I think it can even be possible for topically applied. So that has effects on mood as well as sleeplessness.
So there are a number of side effects that you mentioned. For example, thinning of the skin. One of the consequences of that is telangiectasia, which our patients get, and in particular in areas like the face. We want to avoid using it chronically because patients will develop cutaneous atrophy. In the photograph I'm showing here, every time this patient walked into something lightly, here he banged into a suitcase, he lacerated his skin. You can see how shiny and thin that skin is. You can see the blood vessels right through it. Stretch marks are what we really fear. They are not reversible. All of the others we can treat. You stop the corticosteroid, cutaneous atrophy will reverse itself. doesn't matter to me what laser you have in your office, your patient is not going to get rid of these stretch marks. In particular, intertriginous areas and flexural sites. We often see striae in the groin, we see them in the axillae, but even in the antecubital and popliteal fossae, of which are characteristic sites of involvement for atopic dermatitis. And last but not least, in older patients, we often see purpura as a result of the reduction in collagen in the skin that you get from topical corticosteroids. That cushioning of blood vessels that occurs leads to the purpura that you see in this patient.
Mark, those pictures are really frightening. We don't see that much of a problem in children, but we do see it occasionally, and we also worry about some of the subclinical impact of the topical corticosteroids, particularly in impairing further that epidermal barrier.
So when choosing topical corticosteroids, I try to stick with the ones that have been studied in children, and then I use them to a degree that's not overuse. And this is a table that just shows you the very short list of topical corticosteroids that have been studied in children. So choosing topical corticosteroids for your patients can be sort of complicated. And what I recommend is that every practitioner become familiar with two or three or a handful of products from each potency group. And then when you're prescribing them, choose the lowest effective potency and match it to the degree of severity of disease. And then you consider the vehicle in prescribing them for your patients, because the vehicle is one of the most important variables in terms of patient acceptance. So some people hate ointments and they prefer creams. The cost is also a consideration for many people. The application site. So you certainly wouldn't want to put an ointment on a scalp site. You want to use more of a solution. And then how well you tolerate it. So any products that are other than ointments frequently will burn and sting. So for very young children, they tolerate ointments much better. For my patients, I really think it's important to monitor the corticosteroids. I am very particular about the amount that I give them. I dispense the appropriate amount, and I try not to give them pound jars because they can't gauge how much to use.
Many of us do use pound jars because they're less expensive.
They are.
What is your objection?
I think that's true. It's just very difficult for them to dose. So I've seen small children who are using a pound of corticosteroid a week, and I've seen them that have a pound a year, and they just do not know how much to use. I don't have a problem with pounds, because for people who want to purchase them in pound jars because it's more economical, you can actually have them measure amount to use. So, for example, a two-year-old child who might want to use 30 grams in a couple weeks or in a month, that's just 2 tablespoons. So they can take 2 tablespoons out, and they can put them in a separate container. And then I give them guidelines for dosing. I tell them that it doesn't help to use more than once a day. There's lots of data to support that. If they need to use a product more than once a day, they can use an emollient, or as we'll talk a little bit more, I'm sure, about steroid-sparing products. And then you want to tell them how many grams to use over a period of time, so how many grams per week or how many grams per month. And then the most important thing is that I checked the medications that are dispensed. I have them bring in their tubes at every appointment, because if they use too much, it's bad for you, and if they use too little, it doesn't work. Some people have used the fingertip unit to try to gauge how much of a dose per day, and they've used even tables like the one that's illustrated here about how much corticosteroids to put on depending on the age of the patient or the body surface area that's involved. But when I've added up the quantities of corticosteroids that you have to use to comply with this fingertip unit measurement, I find that it's way more than what my patients need. So for a 0 to 6 month old child who's got total body surface involvement, they certainly don't need 126 grams a month of corticosteroid. So parents, there are two brands of parents, really, in my patient population, the ones who fear corticosteroids, the steroid-phobic parents, and the ones who don't fear it enough and that they way overuse it. So you really have to get to know your parents and get to know your patients and which group they fall into, and then you have to provide them with guidelines about how much corticosteroid to use. And then you have to distinguish between corticosteroids and, say, anabolic steroids, which is has a whole different set of side effects and a whole different fear.
Okay, let's move on to another topical therapy that was introduced about a decade ago, which is the topical calcineurin inhibitors. And I'm just going to show one mechanism graphic to illustrate how these work. There is a molecule that you see in the cytoplasm of this activated T cell here. It's called NF-ATC, and that's a nuclear factor of activated T cells. What happens is that is dephosphorylated by calcineurin. which allows the molecule to enter into the nucleus, where it upregulates the production of inflammatory cytokines. What calcineurin inhibitors do is they prevent that dephosphorylation, and the molecule can't get in, the cell can't make the inflammatory cytokines, and that's why they help atopic dermatitis. There are two topical calcineurin inhibitors on the market. One of them is pimecrolimus. The second one is tacrolimus ointment, pimecrolimus cream and tacrolimus ointment. They have both been studied in thousands of patients for weeks to years and have proven to be very effective for atopic dermatitis. And I'm going to show you a patient that illustrates that. You can see rather severe eyelid eczema in a patient with atopic dermatitis. And in the next slide, you see a before and after. This is after 1 week of application of a topical calcineurin inhibitor, so fairly dramatically effective. Now, I will say that any topical corticosteroid would probably give you that effect as well. But we don't like to use topical corticosteroids on the eyelids. One of the things we didn't mention in the side effects discussion is that they cause cataracts and glaucoma. So the calcineurin inhibitors have been around about 10 years, and then around 2005, the FDA had a hearing in which a pediatric committee proposed a black box warning for these medications. And the rationale behind the black box warning was that systemic calcineurin inhibitors like cyclosporin or oral tacrolimus, which is used as a transplant medication, are associated with an increased risk of lymphoma and of squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. So theoretically, the topical calcineurin inhibitors might do the same thing. And here's the warning as it appears when it's given to patients. Although a causal relationship has not been established, rare cases of malignancy, e.g. skin and lymphoma, have been reported in patients treated with topical calcineurin inhibitors, including Elidel cream is this one, and the identical warning appears with protopic ointment, which is tacrolimus. Elidel is pimecrolimus. And it goes on to suggest that they should not be used every day, long-term, and they should just be limited to localized areas of involvement. Also, they should not be used in children under the age of 2. Now, in that FDA hearing, the industry presented a tremendous amount of data showing that in animal models that are exposed to comparable levels of calcineurin inhibitors, you don't get lymphomas. But if you increase that to hundreds of times the dose that patients are exposed to, yes, you will get lymphomas. We know that from humans because transplant patients who are exposed to multiple doses of what we achieve topically will develop an increase in lymphomas and in squamous cell carcinomas of the skin. Also in those hearings, the companies presented data on the numbers of malignancies they saw in their clinical trials. And interestingly, in the pimecrolimus data, of 19,000 patients treated with topical pimecrolimus, there were 2 malignancies. There were 4,000 patients treated with vehicle, and of the 4,000, there were 5 malignancies. Since that time, there have been many studies, both formal studies and mandatory registries, and also just database studies. And this is one presented by Mark Naylor, in which he looked at the frequency of skin cancers in patients treated with topical tacrolimus and reported that there was not an increase. There are 2 large studies that were started as a result of the concern about malignancy in patients treated with calcineurin inhibitors. One of them looked at pediatric patients ages 3 to 12 months, followed for 5 years, and looked at pimecrolimus cream. And the side effect profile was similar to that of low to medium strength topical corticosteroids. And the side effects that were seen were no different than what you would expect to see in a pediatric age group of that size. There's another ongoing peer registry. It's called the Pediatric Eczema Elective Registry, and it's a 10-year follow-up. It was started in November 2004. They plan to enroll 8,000 patients. As of last March, That's March 2011. Almost 6,000 patients were enrolled. There were almost 17,000 patient years of follow-up, and the Data Safety Monitoring Board reported no safety concerns at all. So, Elaine, what do you tell your patients about the black box warning?
I certainly allude to the fact that we have way more data for pimecrolimus and tacrolimus than we do for corticosteroids, which have been studied in similar types of trials in way smaller numbers and for a much shorter period of time, the longest being about 4 weeks. But it's a hard thing to go into because you don't want to scare them and you don't want to minimize the data. But I tell them that using any medication is about the quantity and the duration. And I often use analogies, so I'll tell them that using the appropriate amount of medication is like driving down the street at the speed limit with your eyes open, and that using too much is like getting in your car and closing your eyes and driving 100 miles an hour down the road. So I think that sound bites often help.
Okay, now the other thing that I wanted to discuss is devices. And there are at this point about 8 devices at least on the market for atopic dermatitis, and they're called devices, but what they really are creams that have been, mostly creams, that have been developed for patients with atopic dermatitis that have ingredients that have not been subjected to the rigors of the clinical trials of drugs, but have shown in much smaller numbers of patients some benefit. Now, some dermatologists consider these no more than moisturizers. And others think that they have a good therapeutic benefit. And I'm curious to hear your opinions. Amy?
Yeah, well, we're talking about devices that have some very different ingredients, many of them, as I mentioned before, with talking about the barrier and lipid deficiencies of ceramide will have increased in ceramide, or trying to more physiologically approach what the actual lipid content in skin is, and then others will actually have anti-inflammatory agents in them that are non-steroidal. We've certainly used all of them. We've found variable benefit in different patients. Many of these are quite costly, and that's probably been the biggest deterrent. Others are really not much more expensive than many of the moisturizers, and we've seen a lot of use in our patients and really appreciation for some of these products. I think that it's wonderful to have new products that come out, and particularly products that are based on what we've learned about problems related to eczema. I like to use them.
And Elaine?
I also think that cost is one of the biggest barriers to using these things. And I tend to stick with plain petroleum jelly because I think it's the most cost effective, although my biggest beef with petroleum jelly is it's not a renewable resource. But with these barrier creams, they're so much more well tolerated, especially for older kids and adolescents and adults. But I'm not convinced about the efficacy compared to other non-prescription barrier approved device creams.
Actually, I'd like to add to that there was just a recent study that the Wake Forest group performed that actually looked at some of these in contrast to a bland ointment that had been around for quite a while and didn't show a great advantage in that study. And so I think that we still need to have a lot more research, but I have no problem with patients who can afford them and want to try them, especially if we've tried many other possibilities without much improvement. But it is something that is an option for our patients, and in many cases is an alternative to moisturizers.
Okay, let's move on and talk about long-term therapy. Atopic dermatitis is a chronic disease. For many patients, you will temporarily improve it with topical therapy, but it comes right back. Amy, how do you manage long-term therapy?
I'm a huge fan of rotational therapy. I think we're so lucky that we have more than just topical corticosteroids right now, and I take full advantage of some of the non-steroidal agents out there, particularly the topical calcineurin inhibitors in my patients. In fact, what I do most commonly now, whether it's a new patient or a follow-up patient, and I'm trying to tweak the regimen, is to talk with them about jumping in with a medium to even potent topical corticosteroid for flares, educating very carefully about the need to control that to no more than 2 weeks, often a few days, depending on the strength, but to try to get that inflammation under very quick control and then move on to something different. Now, that could be a lower strength topical corticosteroid, but for me is often a calcineurin inhibitor, so I can have periods when a patient is on steroids if they need to be, but then is on periods with without steroids so that they don't get some of these side effects, particularly the thinning of the skin that comes from chronic utilization. I have found this to be a very effective approach. Even in my patients with more severe disease, in whom we have to use something daily or even twice daily to continue to suppress the inflammation, it really quells the fear of the parents about corticosteroid usage. It offers alternatives that I think overall improves both the compliance and the response, and it decreases, theoretically, that potential risk of side effects. Now, I will tell you that another alternative that I will use in patients who don't need to have something on absolutely every day is an intermittent type of therapy, more as maintenance. This was initially suggested by use with fluticasone about a decade ago, where it was shown that you could get started with twice daily use and then taper that down and end up just using it as little as twice a week to areas that were recurrently affected, continuing to apply it even when they were clear. And it was shown that this type of an intermittent approach decreased the risk of relapses, requiring you to go back to that twice daily therapy. And in fact, this has now been applied to non-steroidals, particularly topical calcineurin inhibitors. And in fact, it's an indication now in Europe to use tacrolimus twice weekly to skin that appears to be clear or almost clear but is recurrently affected. And there have been studies done in the United States with three times weekly maintenance therapy with tacrolimus ointment, once clear or almost clear, and it has clearly been shown to increase the number of flare-free days and to decrease having to go back to the use of steroids. So I think these are a lot of alternatives, and of course we need to individualize treatment to that given patient. But it gives us options that allow us to go back and forth between steroids and non-steroids, overall decreasing the risks.
Okay, let's talk about managing infections.
Sure. So we talked earlier about that staph colonization, and we know when that bacteria increases in its number that we start to get infections, and there's no question that there's this relationship we talked about earlier with the severity of the atopic dermatitis. So treating infections, we treat and have treated for decades with systemic antibiotics, and I think we all know that that can be very effective, not only in clearing the infection, but also in improving the atopic dermatitis. Interestingly, there's never been a good clinical trial, so some of these evidence-based reviews aren't able to show what we know from decades of use, and that is the value of oral antibiotics. We also know that topical anti-inflammatory agents alone are insufficient to reverse the dermatitis in the face of secondary bacterial infection. So it's important to recognize infections, to treat them with an oral antibiotic. But the big question is, how can we decrease the Staph aureus levels and keep them from going up and causing clinical infection and flaring the atopic dermatitis? One thing I just want to mention is some really interesting work that came out of the UK from Mike Cork, and that is that he's demonstrated that more than 50% of the containers of ointment, whether preserved or unpreserved, of the containers of topical anti-inflammatory products had bacteria, and in fact half of those were Staph aureus. So it reminds us that we have to be careful not to be perpetuating infection in our patients who become infected. I suggest to my patients they keep moisturizers in the refrigerator and just float them in the tub during the bath, and also avoid direct contact with the hands, going to the skin with Staph on it, transferring it back into the moisturizer, but rather to use a tongue blade or a clean spoon and decant what they need to in treatment. The concept of increasing antimicrobial peptide is an interesting one that deserves attention. It's been recently shown that systemic levels of vitamin D3 inversely correlate with the severity of the atopic dermatitis. It's also been shown that vitamin D3 therapy can increase antimicrobial peptide in involved atopic dermatitis skin. Of course, we can't use topical application of vitamin D3 because that in itself leads to a dermatitis. We know that our patients get irritated if we try to put that on, and it's actually been shown that it's due to an increase in TSLP. produced by the vitamin D when applied topically. But we can go with oral vitamin D3. And in fact, 4,000 international units has been shown to induce cathelicidin expression in lesional skin, and some early studies in mild to moderate atopic dermatitis showed that 1,000 international units was enough to cause improvement. The agent that I use quite a bit now is antiseptics. And in fact, an ideal agent would decrease the numbers of bacteria, including in the skin and the nares and the anal area under the nails, without increasing the risk of resistance. So if successful, we could potentially keep bacterial numbers below a threshold and maybe cause improvement in atopic dermatitis. And in fact, that seems to be what's happening with dilute bleach or sodium hypochlorite baths, which have now become the standard of care for maintenance in the United States of at least moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, especially in individuals who've had any history of infection. And in a trial that was reported in pediatrics in 2009, it showed that twice weekly dilute bleach baths were very effective in that trial when coupled with a monthly intranasal mupirocin for the family as well as the patient in decreasing eczema severity and also in decreasing the body surface area that was affected. One interesting component of that study was the observation that it was the bath-submerged areas, the limbs and the trunk, that showed dramatic improvement, statistically significant in a month and very significant by 3 months out, whereas the exposed sites, the head and the neck that weren't submerged, did not show any difference in their severity, suggesting that it really is the baths that make the difference. Now, in those studies, the cultures remained positive for Staph aureus. The numbers may have been decreased, but the culture still showed Staph aureus, emphasizing the need to use this consistently as a preventive way to maintain the control of the atopic dermatitis. And I will mention that in my own patients, I use this daily, particularly if they're more severe, as a means to control that overgrowth of Staph. It has been a dramatic improvement in my patients who repeatedly talk about how valuable that's been.
Okay, well, we all know that topicals don't always work. Elaine, can you talk about therapy beyond topicals?
Just briefly. It's a huge topic, and I wish we had more time to talk about it. But basically, everybody knows the patients that are what I call beyond topical therapy, the ones that just aren't getting better, and they're using all their topicals appropriately and doing their topical care appropriately. I have some guidelines that I've defined for my patients. Corticosteroids more than, say, half of the number of days per month, especially if they're also in combination with adequate uses of steroid-sparing topicals. And then the other big category of people are people who have just insurmountable barriers to adherence with topicals. It's so time-consuming and so difficult to do, and it comes with associated problems like burning and stinging and behavioral issues, that these are patients who are beyond topical therapy. And these are just some illustrations of some of my patients who are easily recognized as being beyond topical therapy. And you all know them when you see them, and everyone has at least one of them in their practice. So what I've learned about these patients is that you certainly can undertreat them, you certainly can give them pounds of corticosteroids, but it's so much better to treat them a little bit more aggressively. So in summary, you really have to evaluate each one of these patients with severe disease on a case-by-case basis. You have to make sure that they aren't colonized or have occult significant infection before you'd ever put them on myelosuppressive therapy. And then you consider some of the treatments that we have evidence about, cyclosporin, methotrexate, or biologics like interferon gamma or IVIG for some of the patients who have chronic infections. But what we really need to do the most is to hope for better treatments.
Okay. We're going to summarize simply by saying that atopic dermatitis, we all agree, is a common condition. It ranges from mild to severe. We've discussed many of the therapies that are available for atopic dermatitis, ranging from emollients, devices, baths, antimicrobial therapies, and spend a good deal of time on topical corticosteroids and topical calcineurin inhibitors. And with that, I'd like to thank my colleagues, Dr. Elaine Siegfried and Dr. Amy Paller, for their words of wisdom. I would also like to thank our viewers for participating in this activity. Please take a moment to complete the post-activity questions in order to receive CME CE credit. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity Atopic Dermatitis Update. To participate in the CME Activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.